Hi, my name is Jill Zamorski, and welcome to Reading and Drinking on the Psalm TV Podcast Network. On today's show, I am going to be talking about a book called The History of Wine in 100 Bottles, From Bacchus to Buena Vista and Beyond by Oz Clark. Y'all, it's the last book of the season, and I don't know how this works out, but somehow I managed to randomly select a book that just falls into the lineup, and the last one for this season, as well as in seasons past, ends up being the perfect culmination of everything that I've reviewed so far. I don't know how it works out, but I am so pleased and excited to share this with you. This episode is brought to you by Sparklers, the new cooking and wine pairing competition show now airing on Psalm TV. Centered around champagne and sparkling wine from all around the world, all 13 episodes star a cast of food and wine professionals who are changing the culinary world. While the show is guest judges, the main challenges are judged by the five contestants themselves, pitting friends against each other as they make tough decisions to create one of the most unique food shows you've ever seen. So this book, let me give you a little bit of an introduction. It is a hardcover book. It's about like 8x9, and it has a very close-up picture of some bottles in a cellar, almost to the point that it's almost a little bit abstract. And the introduction of this book is really critical because the title makes it sound like this is going to be a book about 100 different bottles of wine, which on its face might not sound that appealing to everybody or anybody, but that's not exactly what this book is. And so the introduction is really key. Oz Clark says, "This isn't just a history of 100 bottles, and it's not just a history of wine. This book is 100 stories with wine at their center, embracing all the history and culture of which wine is a part." And I think that's really key because honestly, if I'm going to make a really broad leap, that's kind of the idea with this podcast. It's not just technical books about wine. It's a review of books about which wine plays a central part. Sometimes they are memoirs and sometimes they are technical reference texts, but it's a story of wine. And he goes on further. And I think this is a really important thing to talk about. Is he talks about the kind of stories he's going to tell. And sometimes the stories are about specific bottles, but sometimes they're about events that occurred or technological developments. And he says, "So I suppose it is a history of wine, but I unapologetically admit that it is my version of history. It's the events and the people that I find interesting or amusing or both. There may be bottles missing that you would have included, and I freely accept that. To be honest, I probably could have written the history of wine in 200 bottles had my editor not had the wisdom to say, enough's enough. And even then, I might have still missed some gems." And so he does just clearly state that this is his opinion. He's not passing off his opinion as fact. And I think that's really important because he is a writer and a critic, and writers and critics have opinions. And sometimes, particularly with wine, because it's such a passion for so many people, people get really dogmatic about it. And it's my way or the highway. And he's just saying, look, this is what I think. And it's cool if you don't agree, but this is just my impression. So a little bit about the author. Who is Oz Clark? So he is... Well, he's a lot of things. He's still around. He is a British gentleman, and he is one of the world's leading wine experts. He has a formidable reputation. He doesn't hold particular certifications. He's not a master of wine or a master sommelier, but he has worked as a writer and a TV and radio broadcaster. He's a critic. He's won a bunch of awards and kind of got into wine from his student days at Oxford University and won some tasting competitions at a really young age. Interestingly, before he really got into wine full on, he was a full-time actor and singer, appearing in all different types of shows on the West End in London, like Evita and Sweeney Todd. He is quoted, this is quite a flattering quote, that Oz Clark is the nearest thing to genius in the world of wine writing. I mean, that's not bad. And I have to say this, I've never met him and I've never heard him speak, but one thing that I could not escape as I was reading this book is that when I was a child, and honestly still to this day, I really liked watching nature shows, particularly the ones that were narrated by Sir David Attenborough. And I loved the way he talked, where hyperbole would just be like couched in this like very calm British accent, like, I don't know, approaching the lair of the, I don't know, aggressive and venomous naked mole rat. Let's follow him in. And I can't even do the accent, but it's just, I love the way David Attenborough would talk about animals in the wild kingdom. And I found myself imagining this book narrated with that same kind of accent. I don't know if Oz and David Attenborough sound the same, but I'd like to believe in my mind's eye that they do. So this is a book about the stories of wine, and the way that it's organized is chronological. There is an introduction, obviously, and it starts roughly around 6000 BC. And it continues all the way until about 2014. Now, not every single year is included. This is 100 different entries. And each entry is typically a 2-page spread. Really, it's usually just 1 page of text, maybe a picture or 2 small pictures in that page of text. And then on the other page of that spread is a larger picture with a caption. So the nice thing about this book is it is 100 stories, but it's really digestible bites. And so, yes, some of the stories might be of less interest to you. Some of them might be of much more interest to you, but it ends up being these like neat little snack-sized vignettes about important stories of the world of wine. It all starts off 6000 BC, and it starts off in Georgia. So there's, you know, sometimes there's debate about where winemaking originally started off. And Oz Clark starts talking about Georgia because of all of the places where wine was grown and produced, where we have, you know, ancient evidence of it. Georgia has persevered and cherished a wine culture more closely linked to its past than any of those other countries, such as Turkey or Iran or Armenia or Azerbaijan. So that's sort of why he starts off with Georgia. And he talks about, interestingly, how we believe wine used to be made thousands and thousands of years ago and how it is still sometimes made in that same method. And if you're a wine lover, and if you're familiar with wine from Georgia, the country, not the state at all, one of the things they're most known for is using these big beeswax-lined clay jars called kevevri. And they tread the grapes, they fill up the juice, the skins, the pips, everything into these big kevevri, and then they seal it up, and then it just ferments, and then they crack it open, and they drink it. And so this is a, you know, this sort of style, this non-interventionist style is certainly something that is replicated today with natural wines, which, spoiler alert, gets tackled in this book. And Oz Clark talks about something that is really interesting. When talking about Georgian wine, the author says, "I've tasted a fair few now. Some have made me give thanks for the progress of science over the past 8,000 years, but some have stopped me in my tracks, made me metaphorically throw down my notebook, scour my mind free of preconception, and wallow in amazement that after so many years of wine tasting, something entirely new and thrilling can still stun me." And I think that's really cool. This is the first vignette, and it sort of sets the tone that while he is, as I earlier quoted, as close to a genius in wine writing as apparently some people believe, he is really kind of humble and he seems to be a generalist and he's really open-minded. There's a few instances in this book where his personal preferences sort of creep through, but I really appreciate that he has this kind of open mind and is willing to try and evaluate and consider all different types of wine. So he starts at the very beginning of the world of wine and it continues on through ancient cultures, through Greece, through Egypt, the Phoenicians, through the Roman Empire. And then as we move through the centuries, he does acknowledge that there is a little bit of a gap in time because during the Dark Ages, it was just, there wasn't, it was sort of, I mean, for lack of a better term, it was the dark time and sort of lots of aspects of culture were lost to war and famine and death. And so certainly wine as a culture and as a practice was not something that, you know, we have a lot of evidence of. And so there is a gap from, you know, thousands of years BC to, you know, hundreds and thousands of years AD. So one of the next chapters that I thought was really interesting was a chapter called Steinwein. And this is dated 1540. And he says, "I've never tasted it, but I know a man who has. Hugh Johnson, the famous British wine writer, was one of a tiny group of people gathered in a Mayfair shop of Rudi Nassauer in 1961. Now, the bottle itself was probably something like 250 years old because, and he goes on to detail how old this wine was, that this book details the evolution of various technological advances in the world of wine. And it's important to understand that wine in bottles is a relatively modern invention. For a long time, you know, wine was made in some sort of large vat or jar or cask, and that's how it was shipped. And it was only ever put into some sort of smaller flask or goatskin or eventually bottle when it was actually time to consume it or to serve it. And so this wine obviously spent the first couple hundred years of its existence in a large barrel and then was ultimately bottled. And so he's describing this wine that is believed to be the oldest bottle of wine that has ever been drunk, vintage 1540. And for a little bit of context, Michelangelo was still at work in Rome. King Henry VIII had just married his fifth wife. And Shakespeare wasn't even going to be born for another 24 years. And these guys, Hugh Johnson included, in 1961, were sitting around and tasting fruits of the vintage of 1540. So what was it like? Well, he does tell us Hugh's words. And he says, Hugh says that it was like ancient Madeira, but less acid. Okay, well, Madeira is a fortified wine from Portugal, and this book talks about Madeira. And it is one of its hallmarks, regardless of whether it's sweet or dry, is that it's quite acidic. But he pushes for a little bit more, and he says, all right, what else? Give me some more. And Hugh says, Nothing has ever demonstrated to me so clearly that wine is indeed a living organism, and that this brown Madeira-like fluid still held the active principles of the life that had been conceived in it by the sun of that distant summer. For perhaps two mouthfuls, we sipped a substance that had lived for over four centuries before the exposure to air killed it, gave up the ghost, and became vinegar in our glass. I mean, that's just really cool. I love reading this kind of stuff because I don't know that I will ever have the opportunity to taste wine like that. And I do really enjoy hearing about it. Now, I realize that sometimes I talk about tasting old wine for old wine's sake and how it's not always going to be delicious. But every now and then, you can certainly come across something that will be a real pleasant surprise and delight. As we kind of, I don't know, jaunt, cavort, skip through time, there's just really interesting developments. And a lot of these things are things I was familiar with, such as, you know, Chateau Aubrion, which is a first growth of Bordeaux and how it was detailed in writings, you know, since the 1400s, as I promised, in the 1600s and 1700s, Madeira and its popularity in the New World is discussed. And then every now and then I come across something that's kind of new, and you guys know how much I like learning new stuff. And in particular, a chapter dated 1681, corkscrews. So this is important to include because, as I mentioned, wine was traditionally made and transported in large vats. And it wasn't until wine was put into glass bottles that obviously then a stopper would be necessary. And all different types of stoppers were used. Sometimes they were pieces of wood that were wrapped in like oil-soaked hemp. Sometimes they were just balled up rags and sealed with beeswax. But eventually, and it's also detailed in this book, corks were used. And corks are, they come from the bark of a tree that's native to Spain and Portugal, genus species Quercus suber. And it's really unique that you can actually take the bark off the tree and it doesn't kill the tree, it grows more bark. And you take these big kind of thick sheaves of bark and you boil them to sterilize them. And they're a couple inches thick and you can literally punch out cylinders and that becomes the cork. And so cork is really, you need it. If you look at it under a microscope, it's compressible and it's nearly impervious to, you know, to liquid and to gas. And it's this perfect spongy medium. And it's so great for stopping up a bottle of wine. Then you've got to be able to get it out. So there's a cool picture of all these antique style corkscrews. And he goes on to indicate that the first printed reference in literature to a, quote, steel worm to extract corks was in 1681. And it seems that those steel worms had been used for the previous century for extracting bullets and wadding from guns when they had failed to fire. But if it's good enough for that, it's probably good enough to take a cork out of a bottle. And by the 1740s, straight-sided molded glass bottles had become kind of the norm for wine. And then that allowed them to be stacked horizontally in wine cellars. There was the observation that, you know, over time, sometimes the flavor of wine would improve. And certainly keeping air out would help the flavor be preserved and taste good. And so we needed a way to get the corks out of the bottleneck. And so this is so neat. I didn't know about this, but a British inventor called Charles Hull devised the first bar corkscrew in the 1860s. Now, this is not your waiter's friend. This is, if you've ever seen at the end of a bar, it's like mounted onto the end of a bar or table, and it's like a big lever action, and you just like pull down and the worm goes into the cork, and then you pull up and it pops it right out. So that was invented in the 1860s. It's pretty fierce, pretty heavy duty, and certainly not portable. But in 1882, the waiter's friend was invented. And this is probably what most of us are familiar with. You know, it fits in your pocket and it folds up and it uses leverage. First, you screw in the worm, the helix of the corkscrew, and then there's a lever, and you use that rather than just brute force to pull out the cork. And now things have obviously evolved. The worm has become Teflon coated, so it's nice and smooth. And corkscrews and their like have now become luxury items. I love them. You know, you got to get the cork out of a bottle of wine before you drink it. And so, you know, a $10 pull tap is going to work, but also a really nice Code 38 is going to make you feel extra special while you do it. So it's just really cool to learn the actual timeline, not just of all the elements that necessitated a corkscrew, but actually when corkscrews were put into existence. I thought that was kind of cool. So much of the little facts that I learned in this book are like the mundane, but I feel that they just like fill in little gaps of things that I never thought to question. And sometimes, like I said, Oz Clark, he talks about the rarest and the finest and the most expensive and the oldest, but then he also talks about like the really commonplace. And sometimes the wines he talks about are so common, they have gone on to be stereotypical. And one of those stereotypical things that we imagine in the diaspora of wine is the traditional fiasco bottling for Chianti. So if you've not seen this, you could look at a cartoon of an Italian restaurant scene. And it's basically this flask-shaped bottle of wine. And then the bottom part of the bottle is wrapped in straw. And more often than not, that cartoon stereotypical image, once the wine was emptied, maybe a candle would be placed in that bottle and the wax would drip down. And it's just, you know, a red and white checkered tablecloth. You can imagine the scene. Why was that a thing? Well, in the one-page little story about Chianti dated 1716, the flask was so distinctive, so Tuscan in everybody's mind. But it did not prove to be a symbol of quality abroad. The flask itself, the bottle, was blown from glass and had been blown that way since at least the 12th century. And so, obviously, glass blowing is an artisanal skill, but maybe some were more skilled than the others. And so, blowing the glass in this flask shape resulted in a very fragile bottle. So purely out of stability and utility, the straw covering was introduced in the 15th century to add support to those rudimentary OG original blown glass flask bottles. And it remained a symbol of Chianti until the end of the 20th century. However, it has now been disdained and is now more of a little bit of a joke. And you don't typically see quality Chianti bottled in that old fashioned shape. But it had a very practical purpose for its inception. And certainly, you know, became something that many of us can be familiar with. One of kind of a funny thing that I read in this book that has nothing to do so much with history as more pop culture occurs in the chapter on decanters. And so decanters are really fun. And this is a question I get asked a lot from consumers. You know, is it necessary to decant wine? And when or why would it be necessary to decant wine? Typically, there's a couple different reasons why we might decant wine. If a red wine is made from thick-skinned grapes over time, in the bottle, just very teeny tiny pieces of skin, and then obviously color and tannin, they can polymerize and form these big long chain molecules that fall out of solution and you get a deposit in the bottle. And it's kind of the texture of espresso grounds. And it's completely harmless, but it tastes like drinking espresso grounds. And so if you have stored a bottle very carefully, either upright or horizontally, by not adjusting its orientation, opening it and carefully pouring it off into another container, you can separate the liquid from the heavier sediment. The shape and the construct of the container varies wildly. You could use a Kool-Aid pitcher. You could use some fancy hand glass, beautiful crystal vase. You could use another wine bottle. There's a lot of different things that you can use. It's the purpose of separating the wine for the sediment. There's also other reasons. Some wines just taste better with a little bit of oxygen, so it aerates the wines. And so this might be why sometimes you see people decanting white wines. They won't have sediment because you don't use the skins to make the white wine, but a little bit of air might make them taste better. It's also really helpful to decant wines if you want to adjust the temperature. So if the bottle was stored in a really cold cellar, and the glass, of course, is cold, and the liquid is cold, if you remove the liquid from the cold bottle glass, then it'll warm up a little sooner. Or if you want to chill it down, typically the decanter glass, typically, is thinner than the glass of the bottle, so you could submerge the decanter of decanted wine into an ice bucket. Lots of different reasons. That's not the point. What he talks about is how the shape of decanters has changed throughout the 18th century. This is a chapter dated 1740s, and how sometimes they have handles and sometimes they don't. And he says that claret jugs, by the way, and the claret jug is, it's footed and then it's kind of ovoid in shape and then has like a long neck and then a handle. So it almost looks like a very fancy watering jug, like a watering can, except for made out of crystal. So you probably wouldn't want to use the same thing for both purposes. But this claret jug, by the way, he says, are still designed and used, not least by golfers. And that kind of caught my attention. Very good golfers, he says. The claret jug is the trophy for the Open Golf Championship. In 2014, it was won by Irishman Rory McIlroy, who, I did not know this, who promptly celebrated by filling the venerable jug with Jägermeister. If you guys didn't know, I love Jägermeister. I have zero chill about this fact. I love all sorts of bitter beverages, Amaros, Amari, I love them. And Jaeger was one of the first shots I ever took in my youth. And I pretty much have had a bottle of it in my freezer ever since. I have one there now. When people come over to my house with a mixture of shock and delight, they see that in my freezer if they're helping themselves to something from my freezer. And I love Rory McIlroy. He's a precious little Irish golfer. He's super talented. I had no idea about this. And it's just so funny that this like beautiful golf trophy filled it with Jägermeister. Shots. So every now and then there's just something funny and pop culture in this book in the middle of like super historical, interesting fact-finding kind of information. So never ceases to amaze. Now, one of the things I like most about this book, and I've said this about British writers before, is they tend to generally use all of my favorite grammatical terms correctly. Oz Clark is no exception. But I did find one thing that I thought was a little bit erroneous. And it comes in the mid-1800s in a section on large format bottles. And large format bottles, so the standard wine bottle is 750 milliliters. And you can certainly have smaller bottles. It's not uncommon to see a half bottle, 375. And depending on the style of wine, Champagne and Bordeaux are two really good examples. There are oftentimes much larger bottles. And I will say that because each chapter, vignette, story is only a page with pictures, you never get quite as much detail as you might want, but I think it's enough to like pique your interest. And if you wanted to find out more, you certainly could. And there's a picture of all the different ranges of champagne bottles from Veuve Clicquot, and then a whole bunch of different bottles of Bordeaux. And it's tricky when you're trying to memorize, there's lots of mnemonic devices, when you're trying to memorize the different bottle sizes and their appropriate volumes, because we use different names for wines from different places. It's a little tricky, and that's not really the point of this chapter. But one thing he says that made me mark the page is specifically, he says, it's worth remembering that if somebody offers you a monster bottle of champagne, that anything more than a magnum will have been created by refilling the big beast with wine from smaller bottles. That can't do the flavor any good. With all respect, that's not correct. So it depends on the producer. Some producers will, and we won't talk about small format bottles. If you ever see a quarter size bottle, a 1.87 milliliter bottle of champagne, the wine is not made in that bottle. It is definitely transferred under pressure. Half bottles, it depends on the producer. Wine is typically made most commonly in 750s, standard bottles, and magnums, which are 1.5 liters. However, in champagne, depending on producer, some of them do make the wine and put it through secondary fermentation in the bottle. They don't transfer the contents. And I know this because, for example, y'all know I represent the Moët Hennessy portfolio of champagnes. Rouenart and Krug only bottle wines up to 3 liters, but they make those in the bottle. Dom Pérignon will go larger, and you can actually have, it's very uncommon, but you can be in the cellars of these maisons and you can see a 3 liter bottle in the riddling rack, and they are riddled by hand. And so it's a very small thing, right? Most people aren't going to really care about that, but don't let that discourage you from buying big monster bottles of champagne. If you can, if you have the means, you do you. Now, of course, the limiting factor is going to be several fold. Because it is the end of the year, and because despite my fervent wish that people would drink champagne all year round, the simple fact of the matter is most people drink the majority of champagne they consume at the end of the calendar year for holidays and whatnot. So here's a little PSA. You buy the biggest bottle you want and that you can afford. But there's a couple of things you need to consider. Big bottles are really, really heavy, and it takes a lot longer to chill the wine down. So if you are in a cold climate, if it's not going to get below freezing, I mean, I love a snooler myself, where you have enough snow outside, you can just stick a bottle in it and chill your bottle down. But having worked in restaurants for so many years, and oftentimes having large bottles for celebration at the end of the year, typically what a good option is if you have, you know, like a Nebuchadnezzar, like a 15 liter bottle, it's really heavy. It weighs like 60, 70 pounds. So first of all, it might take a couple of people to, you know, to actually lift and pour it, unless you're very, you know, strong. But if you put it in a really sturdy trash bag and then put the bottle in the trash bag in like a clean garbage can and then fill it up with ice, it will take a long time. Or you can just stick it in a walk-in refrigerator for a week, but many of us don't have walk-in refrigerators at our home. And so you put the bottle in the bag first to protect the label so it doesn't get wet and damaged. And then it's easier to handle a dry but cold bottle of champagne. It is really tricky. It's going to take a lot of help. And this would be one case where I fervently encourage the decanting of champagne, because the opening of a very large bottle of champagne is much larger than normal. And so even if you can hoist it, trying to carefully pour that champagne into whatever glass you choose, it's going to be harder to control the flow. It's much easier and more appropriate to decant it into some sort of other vessel and then fill your glasses from there. So that's your champagne large format PSA. It has nothing to do with this book, but everyone I know in the wine trade and in the champagne trade specifically does argue that bigger is better when it comes to bottles. A magnum is the perfect size of champagne, really of all wine, for two people, especially if one of them's not drinking very much. That's from Frederick Paniotis, Chef de Cave at Rouenart. But big is better, but it's possible to have wine made in the large format bottles bigger than a magnum, just FYI. Sorry, but I'm going to disagree with you right there. So as I mentioned in the very beginning, one of my thoughts when I was reading this book are the voice of Oz Clark in my mind is that of David Attenborough. And as I pass forward a little bit, we get into the 20th century, to 1931. And this story is about a bottle of port called Quinta de Noval Nacional. And each chapter has a date, a title, and then there's like an intro sentence or two, and then there's like the page of text. And it's, and I won't do the, I won't do the accent, but he says, this is how it's introduced. He says, "Have I ever tasted the world's rarest port, Quinta de Noval Nacional 1931? Tasted it? I've drunk it, old boy. Knocked it back straight from the bottle. Set me up nicely for a jug of Pimm's." Oh my God, I love this guy so much. And he says, "Port lovers go pale when I tell this tale. They break out in a sweat." But he tells a story of when he was in college, or rather at university. And then when he was at Oxford, there's different colleges, and not having, you know, been there, as I understand it, different colleges at Oxford have like wine cellars that the students would have access to. And he is talking about how he has a friend named Andrew who mentioned to him that in their college wine cellar, there were stacks and stacks of the Quinta de Noval 1931. And his friends had come to a drinks party. Oz had been playing cricket, but he thought he'd go because Andrew always seemed to have attractive girls fluttering around him. And he went to the party, and Andrew, Oz's friend, handed Oz a half bottle of wine. No glass, just the wine. Quinta de Noval 1931. All on the roof terrace, full of attractive girls and fellas, all holding half bottles of Noval 1931. And he says, "I'm not sure that some of them didn't have straws." And the point of this story is he goes on to talk about the port industry and how world effects and the Great Depression bottomed out the market, and how it was one of the greatest vintages of port, but the demand just absolutely bottomed out. And so an English merchant basically took a risk, took the lot of 1931. And the Quinta de Noval Nacional, by the way, is a single Quinta port. Most port comes from multiple different estates, but there are single estate, like a single estate wine. And this particular plot comes from own-rooted vines, so vines that weren't grafted to escape phylloxera. So it's like super rare, super special, super old. And somehow he ended up at a college party where their university or their college wine cellar just had stacks on stacks, and they were just hitting it right from the bottle. And he says that, why did his college have such a store? Well, the price being asked when they purchased this wine was just 30 pence a bottle. Much cheaper than the 1927. They were probably just trying to stock up on the cheap wine. Bless them. So they certainly, I mean, that, and that would be a wine, like a very, very high quality, exceptional vintage port, if stored correctly, is a wine that can last for decades. And so if it still exists, like I'd bet good money that it would still taste good if there is any left after Oz Clark and his college chaps, you know, depleted the stocks. Oh, to have been around in those days. I realize this is a little bit of a chronological kind of hopping back and forth. But one of, I think, the coolest stories in here is dated 1860, and it details Louis Pasteur. And so you're probably familiar with Pasteur, if nothing else, because you've heard the term pasteurization. So every time you pick up a bottle of milk in the supermarket, you should basically be reminded of Louis Pasteur. Pasteurized milk is so common and accepted as the norm that we just kind of take for granted who was behind it all. And there's this great picture. It's, of course, a two-page spread. And there's a painting by a Finnish artist of Louis Pasteur. And Oz Clark's commentary is that he looks like an amateur scientist popping by his chemistry set after dinner to do a quick experiment before joining the gentleman for a port. And it's literally a portrait of him just looking at a bottle. Like, it reminds me of, I don't know, of all the invariable headshots of people in the wine industry, like contemplatively, like looking at a glass of wine, like middle distance look away kind of photo. And this picture of Louis Pasteur, like wistfully looking at like a little beaker in his lab. It's an odd portrait, but it's a really important inclusion. And so pasteurization, we now know, is whereby you can kill virtually all microorganisms by heating and rendering whatever you are heating, whatever liquid, sterilized, essentially. And so we think about that with, you know, with milk. But one thing that was really important is that in 1860, Louis Pasteur describes the process of fermentation. Now, it's important to know that wine had been fermenting for 8,000 years, but no one knew exactly what was happening. So they knew that if you got grapes and you crushed them, like it would foam and froth and get all, you know, hot and bothered. And then eventually you would have a liquid that tasted totally unlike the grape juice. And then when you slurped it back, quote, "it made you bright and witty, flirtatious, playful, poetic, emotional, all-conquering, unsteady, cross-eyed, unintelligible, comatose, and when you woke, very thick-headed." Yes, all down to the effects of alcohol. But what was alcohol and how did it create itself? So people knew about yeasts, but Pasteur is the one who showed that fermentation was not a spontaneous activity, but entirely predictable process whereby yeasts eat the sugar available in a liquid to create a precise amount of alcohol and carbon dioxide, and you can calculate it depending on how much sugar is available. And so once this was understood, modern wineries could exert control over a wine's fermentation, and they could achieve different results with specific yeast. They could regulate the speed and the temperature and the length of fermentation. And one of the things that was so interesting is in this time, in the mid-1800s, one of the biggest problems was why wine turned sour so quickly. And so just for a little point of reference, Louis Pasteur came from the Jura region of France, and he also had a vineyard, and spoiled wine was quite commonplace. So he did all these different experiments with all different faults, sourness, sliminess, sludginess, opacity. He put all the samples under his microscope, and he saw that each fault or defect was being caused by different microorganisms. And the more bacteria in the wine, the quicker the wine turned. But the bacteria needed oxygen, Pasteur discovered. So a jug of wine open to the air goes off really quickly. Wine sealed in a test tube without any air didn't decay at all. So in addition to explaining fermentation and being able to calculate how much alcohol you could get by how much sugar you had available, he also was able to help scientists and winemakers tackle the problem of wine inevitably turning to vinegar. And by doing that, the creation of fine wine specifically meant for aging could flourish. And then Pasteur went off and invented a vaccine for rabies. Clever guy. There you go. So I'm so glad this is included in here, because this book is just, there's so many little and interesting stories that just fill in the gaps of our knowledge. Like, you probably knew of his role and importance in the world of wine, but just, you know, all these cool little specific stories that I think are so, so fascinating. Once we get into the 20th century, things really speed up. And there's so many kind of interesting stories, from the Bollinger Champagne Company's role in protecting the Champagne name, to futuristic wine vessels, you know, moving away from glass as early as the 1960s. And as I mentioned, this book ends up being the perfect kind of culmination of everything I talked about of the season so far. And there's a 1963 entry about Miguel Torres, who was detailed in 10 Great Wine Families, and how they like really revolutionized Spanish wine with the introduction of their Viña Sol and Sangre de Toro wine brands. One of the things that when I talk about Oz Clark being really objective and open-minded, there is a chapter entitled 1964 on Gallo Hardy Burgundy. And I mean, this book talks about Blue Nun Liebfraumilch. It talks about Matus from Portugal. It talks about Bag in a Box. So while it does talk about the rise of the chateaus or vintage port or Robert Mondavi and the birth of Napa, it also talks about really kind of low price point, not necessarily what we think of as, you know, as fine wine. It really covers the gamut. And he's not snobby about that. Honestly, the only time I think I detected a little bit of snobbery in this book was in the chapter on prestige cuvées of champagne. And he might have referred to them as a little bit of style over substance sometimes, not always. And there's like a slight bit of condescension there. But then, you know, he talks about wine brands in the 1970s. So Blue Nun and Kanga Rouge, Kunawar Shiraz. And I did not know that that was a thing, but it's hilarious. Kanga Rouge. And he talks about Yellowtail, right? And he says, I'm almost happier to see brands that are total creations, because brands are there to take away fear in choosing a wine, to provide reassurance in a confusing arena. And he goes on to say that brands have done a remarkable job in the 20th century, and they provide a jumping off point to something much better. And this is in stark contrast to stuff that other folks have said, that if you start off drinking big branded kind of pedestrian wines, like you'll never make the jump into something bigger and better. And I don't necessarily think that's the case, because I know what I drank in college. I drank Boone's Farm and I drank Mad Dog 2020, which is covered in here, just so you know. And I've certainly made my my step into the fine wine world. And I do really appreciate it when one of the most knowledgeable people out there recognizes the importance in the history of the story of wine, that all of these different wines and wine-like beverages, they all do really play a part. Keeping things, you know, the summation of this season, there is a detailed chapter about the Judgment of Paris. So Steven Spurrier and his life in wine. I just talked about Godforsaken Grapes and how that title came from Robert Parker in an online screed against esoteric grape varieties. And lo and behold, of course, there is a chapter dedicated to Robert Parker and Parker Points. One of my favorites is a chapter about varietal labeling. And you guys know. And he details the rise and why it is important, why we use that term. He doesn't talk about variety versus varietal. I can't not talk about it, but my homegirl, JR, Jancis Robinson, she did espouse this theory that as the wine production regions outside of Europe arose in prominence, the regions didn't have the history or the legal codification that regions in Europe did. And Oz Clark talks about this. So if you are drinking a Sancerre, it's not going to say Sauvignon Blanc on the label. You just are supposed to know that Sancerre, if it's white, is Sauvignon Blanc. Or if you're drinking Burgundy and it's red, it's Pinot Noir. And that's fine because in the Loire Valley or in Burgundy, those rules have and traditions have been around for centuries. But in Oregon or California or Chile, the place is not so legally and inextricably connected to a grape. So as these wine regions around the world started, you know, producing more and more wine and getting well known, the wines were labeled with the grape variety, and we call that varietal labeling. And so while he does not draw the distinction here, he does talk about the rise of varietal labeling. I think it just goes further on in proving my point. So there you go. The most expensive bottle of wine at its time ever sold, the Thomas Jefferson Lafitte bottle, as detailed in previous season, is included in here. And there are some extremes. And then the last chapter, I should say, and this book was published in 2015. So the last chapter is dated 2014. And it talks about wine fraud and Rudy Kerney-Allen. And of course, that made its way into Tangled Vines and The Billionaire's Vinegar and other books that I've talked about. And so there's actually pictures from Rudy's trial, some evidence, labels and capsules and bottles that were introduced as evidence. But it's very comprehensive. It really proves to be the most perfect summation for the season. So I talk about all these stories. I barely scratched the surface. There's 100 of them. I've only talked about a few. What works in this book? This book is great. I really, really love this book. The photos are beautiful. The writing is witty. It is correct, with minor instances about a kerfuffle over bottle sizes in champagne. But it's really funny in a very like light, witty way. And it's really, it's a very neat approach. As for what doesn't work, I think the only thing that I could say, and it's not even the intention of this book, is that you only do get a little sip. You only get a little taste of each subject matter. But I think it's enough, and they're interesting enough, that if you want to know more, you can. The internet is right there. There's lots of other books. This podcast talks about a few. You can go into deeper detail. So it just does scratch the surface. But by doing so, only in a 2-page spread for each of the 100 stories, it means that this is a book that is a quick read. It's interesting. And it covers so many different facets of the wine world that I think it's actually going to be interesting to anyone who's interested in wine, in history, in anything. And if you're not particularly captivated by something, flip 2 pages and get to the next thing. Like, it's not like you even have to skip a whole chapter. It's literally one little, you know, blip, and you can find something else new and interesting. And I love, love, love finding a book where, you know, obviously it's stuff I'm familiar with, but where I learn something new. And yet again, I find a book where I am able to learn something new, and I love it. It makes me happy. I feel like it makes me a better wine professional. And I thought this was a real winner. So if you couldn't tell, for the last book of season 3, The History of Wine in 100 Bottles, this is a buy this book. It's just a really clever and fun and cool book. And I really like how it takes thousands of years of wine production and story and trade and sale, and it still manages to make a coherent story. That's impressive. So I guess that quote that I mentioned in the beginning of the book, how he's a genius of wine writing, I guess that's true, because I thought this book was a triumph and I really loved it. And it was funny. Kind of makes me want a shot of Jägermeister from a fancy decanter. But anyway, you do you. Drink some big bottles and go out and buy this book, or gift it to somebody. If you know a wine lover in your life, this would be an excellent gift for somebody, because again, it's approachable to a novice, to a connoisseur, to a history buff, to a science lover. It's kind of got a little bit something for everyone. Thank you again for tuning in. I really hope that you enjoyed it. Hope you found some books that you also want to read and some stuff to drink along with. We have enjoyed it, and signing off for season 3 of Reading and Drinking. We'll see you soon. This episode was brought to you by Sparklers, the new cooking and wine pairing competition show on SOMTV. Centered around champagne and sparkling wine from all around the world, all 13 episodes star a cast of food and wine professionals who are changing the culinary world. While the show is guest judges, the main challenges are judged by the 5 contestants themselves, pitting friends against each other as they make tough decisions to create one of the most unique food shows you've ever seen.